I'm Christopher Lydon. In this year of India, puzzling through the Pakistan question next door, the giant nuclear-armed neighbor, with Farzana Sheikh, whose new book is called Making Sense of Pakistan. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Farzana Sheikh was born and grew up in Pakistan. She writes about it now sort of as the daughter of a distressed family. The thread in everything I've read of you, Dr. Sheikh, is that Pakistan's problem is not fundamentally with India, much less with the U.S., though it's been a complicated relationship. Its problem is with itself.
Absolutely. This is a country at war with itself. It is a country that is deeply conflicted. And the center of that conflict, to my mind, lies in its relationship, a very vexed relationship, I might add, with Islam, which, after all, defined the state at its inception. And 60 years after its creation in 1947, that relationship remains as vexed today as it was at the outset.
So, when you go back to the beginning, 1947, Pakistan was formed of those northern territories, east and west, in the British Raj, but then huge numbers of people migrated or felt forced into Pakistan at the beginning. It was a Muslim state, but not an Islamic state. It had a constitution too. There has been, as you write, this puzzle from the beginning about what was the relationship of Islam to the nation. You write about it still as the sort of fundamental identity puzzle of the place.
Yes, yes. It's a very curious phenomenon because Pakistan, of course, emerged in 1947 as the first Islamic Republic in history. At the same time, it was not a theocracy in the sense that it was not led by members of the religious establishment. Indeed, the religious establishment were almost uniformly hostile to Pakistan because the movement for Pakistan was led by a man and a party they judged were driven by so-called secular interests. Nevertheless, right from the start, there was a tension, even within this secular leadership, about whether or not Pakistan was meant to represent purely a homeland for Muslims, concerned to safeguard their economic and political rights and interests against a dominant Hindu majority, and the idea of Pakistan as a safe haven for Islam. The latter was an idea that also received much attention within this secular leadership. So there's always been this tension, as it were, between Pakistan as a secular project and the country as a safe haven for Islam. And that conflict has not yet been resolved.
Salman Rushdie also writes about it as a palimpsest. A palimpsest, as he says, obscures what it covers. One of the things it covers is a fundamental sibling rivalry as the little kid brother of India from the beginning. Take that apart.
Absolutely. I mean, it is that kid brother. But precisely, I think this idea of the brother is an interesting one because kid it might be, but as brothers, it has always demanded to be treated as equal.
Nuclear-armed brother, too.
And a nuclear-armed brother, too. And again, that has sort of given clout to Pakistan's claim that it is indeed the equal of India. An idea that, I might add, had very strong historical roots.
Go back to the Muslim beginning. It deepens the contrast with secular Hindu India. In your version, how has that played out in the history, even to today? And the turmoil in Pakistan that we're all anxious about?
Well, I think one compelling example lies in the country's troubled constitutional development. I mean, the country has had three constitutions in 1956, 1962, and 1973. And all of them, without exception, have been plagued overwhelmingly by the debate and the lack of resolution about the question of the role of Islam in the collective life of the country. And this tension, as I said, has not yet been resolved. So really what you have here is a rather muddled vision of a state that, on the one hand, aspires to some kind of equality for all of its citizens, but at the same time, under the law of the land, is not able to guarantee that kind of equality.
Dr. Sheikh, how does the Islamic question play out in the open public turmoil in Pakistani politics today?
Well, what we have today in Pakistan is, as you rightly put it, a country in deep turmoil. Much of that turmoil, to my mind, of course, is driven by the confusion over the state's Islamic identity. And I have argued that the constant demand by the international community on Pakistan to do more in fighting the war against terror cannot really be addressed unless Pakistan clarifies its own position regarding Islam. Now, of course, the case has been made repeatedly that Pakistan stands for what is known as moderate Islam. The difficulty here is that there is no consensus on what moderate Islam actually represents. So while today Pakistan has made, I would say, considerable strides in tackling the militant challenge, in taking on the militancy, in standing against the worst aspects of extremist Islam, people still don't know what Pakistan stands for, because that standing for has hinged so very largely on Islam, on which there is no consensus.
Salman Rushdie at Brown just a couple of weeks ago left people kind of gasping when he said at the end of a very elegant talk, he said, if the Pakistan problem can somehow be solved, it'll be a boon to mankind. If it's not, we're cooked. It's over. I mean, the real meltdown of the world will not be in Jerusalem, much less in Afghanistan, but in Islamabad.
Well, let me put it this way. I mean, I'm not amongst those who thinks or believes that Pakistan is an insoluble problem. Pakistan is a problem, but there are solutions. And to my mind, really, there are two urgent ways in which one might get around this problem. One is what I would call a fresh constitutional settlement for the country that would unequivocally, unambiguously refuse to empower the citizens of the state on the basis of their putative relationship to Islam. The opposition to that, of course, would sound extremely familiar, which is to say that, you know, this state was created in the name of Islam, and therefore there is no question but for Islam to remain at the heart of this country's constitutional identity. The second issue, I think, which is important, is, of course, for Pakistan to make peace with its neighbours, and most importantly, to make peace with India, to make peace above all with Pakistan's own South Asian identity. This identity has been eroded with very damaging consequences. This identity, which once might have been able to embrace a much more universal idea of what consensus might mean in a Muslim country, has been eroded under the influence of what might be called Salafi or Wahhabi Islam, which seeks a much more pristine and so-called purer version of Islam. And
influence. What's the nearest model for Pakistan of a pluralist Islamic state?
We have Indonesia as one good example. I mean, this is not to say that Indonesia doesn't have its problems, but I mean, Indonesia and Pakistan make for quite interesting comparisons. Both are multicultural and multi-ethnic societies. You know, both are Muslim majority, of course. In both, there have been strong traditions of local forms of Islam that have made their peace with local forms of non-Islamic religious practices.
What does Pakistan want to learn from the relatively pluralist Islamic culture of Indonesia?
One interesting lesson, I think, that Pakistan can learn from Indonesia and is, of course, the way in which Pakistan handled the extremely divisive issue of a national language, Urdu, spoken by a very small minority in Pakistan. The problem here centered on the fact that Urdu was seen to have been imposed by a state on a country where there were already very strong linguistic traditions attached to the country's main ethnic groups, Punjabis, Sindhis, Balochis, etc. Nevertheless, none of those languages were regarded as being fit to be a national language. In the 1950s, the Bengalis, who eventually split to form their own state in 1971 of Bangladesh, mounted a huge campaign to have Bengali, then spoken by almost 58% of the population, to be accepted as the national language instead of Urdu. And their demands were quite brutally crushed. And the grounds of that rejection are what interest me. For the grounds of that rejection, and indeed those grounds still continue to this day, is that these regional languages did not have the same links to Islam as Urdu. Urdu was seen as the language of Islam and therefore the most fitting language for a Muslim country.
Fascinating. Could it help to think of Pakistan alongside Israel, born almost exactly the same time, with a religious identification, but not exactly a religious state?
Well, the comparison between Pakistan and Israel, of course, has been made repeatedly. As you rightly point out, two states created at roughly the same time, 1947 for Pakistan, 1948 for Israel. But I think historically, of course, the contradictions in Pakistan were much more acute than those in Israel. I mean, one of the most striking differences here is, of course, that unlike Israel, which, like Pakistan, was also projected as a refuge and a homeland for Jews, Pakistan, which was also made out to be and promoted as a refuge and a homeland, did not have a right of return policy for Muslims. Indeed, those barriers came down very quickly in 1951 and 1952. Today, simply being Muslim, or indeed from the 1950s onwards, simply being Muslim anywhere in South Asia did not give you the right to come and settle in Pakistan, making a mockery of the claim that Pakistan was a homeland. And of course, this issue has created a great deal of controversy and anger inside Pakistan.
And what does that do to Pakistan's sense of itself as the vessel of a world religious vision?
Well, exactly. I mean, it again, I think, focuses attention right back to the central contradiction, which, to my mind, continues to rumble on in Pakistan today. I mean, the idea of Pakistan could not be squarely reconciled with a territorial idea of nationalism, as this was seen to go against Islam's broad universalism. What is going on, I think, is a tension between, on the one hand, the vision of Pakistan as a nation state and the vision of Pakistan as an Islamic movement.
Dr. Sheikh, you seem to be urging the patient, so to speak, to get over its theocratic temptation, to get over its Islamist vision and identity. But I keep wondering what sort of political, emotional, not to mention religious leap would it take to get there?
An enormous leap. And I do not want to underestimate the Herculean political will it's going to take. But to my mind, the crisis, as I've said, in Pakistan is really so grave, not just for Pakistan, but also for the international community as a whole, that nothing short of a radical solution will really address the roots of this crisis.
How does the international pressure on Pakistan help or hurt in your cause? The pressure from the United States, for example, to go to war on the Taliban.
At the moment, of course, as you must know, I mean, anti-American sentiment is rife in Pakistan. There is very grave and deep hostility to the United States, which is blamed for having involved Pakistan in a war not of its making. This relationship between the United States and Pakistan has always been a fraught relationship. It is a relationship that I define in my book as one based on mutual dependence, not mutual respect. What you're seeing today in Pakistan is, of course, that relationship under immense strain. Having said that, as far as what the United States or indeed the international community can do to help Pakistan in this moment of grave crisis, well, really very little. This is Pakistan's problem, and Pakistan needs to solve it.
Given Pakistan's history, it might have been a rocky relationship with us no matter what. It's been deeply complicated in a downhill direction since 9/11 and the long, strange relationship between President Bush and General Musharraf. There's Afghanistan and Osama bin Laden hiding across Pakistan's border. Pakistan never did enough, and yet it's hugely dependent on our military aid. No appreciable good result after all these years. How does that all bear on this fundamentally conflicted friend of yours, Pakistan?
The relationship as it stands now is under immense strain, and it has been since 9/11. And really,
just take that apart a little bit. When you say strain, what are we talking about?
Well, that strain centers primarily on what many people like to describe as a trust deficit. I mean, essentially, what that involves is the feeling, and that feeling hasn't been eased to this day since 9/11. And that feeling has to do with the suspicion that Pakistan's military is playing what is known as a double game with the United States, and that double game involves, on the one hand, appearing to act as a reliable partner in the war on terror, taking on the face of it, Islamic militants who pose a threat to coalition forces in neighboring Afghanistan and possibly even pose a threat to Western targets, but at the same time holding some of those groups in reserve as strategic assets. Now, the question is, what do we mean here by strategic assets, and assets against whom or for what purpose? And essentially, what I mean by strategic assets are groups that Pakistan's military believes can be used as local proxies to secure Pakistan's national security interests in neighboring Afghanistan and in Kashmir. What's complicated the situation now and what has left the military in a bit of a quandary is that some of these groups have chosen to act autonomously of their paymaster, in other words, the Pakistan military, and have decided for reasons of their own, but mainly because of their anger at the presence of US and Western troops in the region, to take on the state of Pakistan. And of course, by the state of Pakistan here, I mean, you know, the military. Take on the military for its alliance with the United States. So we do have, at this point in Pakistan, an extremely difficult situation where a key state institution, which believed that it could control and contain dangerous groups, appears on the face of it to be losing control of some of those groups.
Dr. Sheikh, are you saying in effect, though, that the ambivalence of the Pakistani military and intelligence forces with respect to Islamist militants of the most violent stripe is a reflection of the identity puzzle of around Islam from the beginning?
What I am saying is that the military in Pakistan must be seen as an institution that is operating within an extremely confused ideological climate. And everything suggests, to my mind, and I have written about it, that the military, as much as our political classes, have been vulnerable to the confusion and the ambivalence that has blighted this country. Of course, the military has tried to resolve this ambivalence, sometimes by force, as we have seen in the 1980s, by imposing its own version of Islam, as General ضیاء-الحق did in the 1980s, a very literalist, punitive version of Islam. But precisely the lack of consensus over Islam has meant that even the military, with all the coercive powers at its disposal, has not conclusively been able to stamp its own version of Islam. Nevertheless, today we find an interesting situation because while in the past the military could ultimately rely on keeping alive a conflict with India to hold the country together, that option is no longer acceptable to the international community. In fact, the pressure on Pakistan's military at the moment is huge to turn its forces away from India, and to regard militants as the enemy. The difficulty for this, of course, is that it forces the military now openly to craft some kind of new narrative based on Islam, to tackle the Islam of the militants. So, for example, you have General Kiani, our current head of state, today, talking about the Pakistan military being the representative of a more authentic version of Islam than that presented by Islamist militants who are seen to be not good Muslims or less than good Muslims. And of course, you know, this is again, to my mind, you know, an experiment doomed to fail because you will never get a consensus on Islam.
Farzana Sheikh, this is an opportunity for us to ask all sorts of questions about Pakistan, which we don't pretend to understand. May we just kind of let fly with citizen questions?
You know, I don't sit here as an oracle. I think Pakistan has to be one of the most complicated countries in the world. You know, people have described India as being complicated, and it is, you know, hugely multi-ethnic, extremely diverse, argumentative in the extreme. But Pakistan's problems are just so much more acute, so much more fundamental. Ultimately, had we not lived in the world that we live in now, we might well have said, well, you know, they made their bed, let them go lie on it. But you can't do that with Pakistan anymore.
You can't do that really with the children of any imperial past. They didn't make their own bed entirely.
True, true. And I think you know, there are historians, myself included, who would argue that British colonial officials did bear a responsibility for the attention and the importance given to religious divisions in India. So I think you're quite right in saying that it isn't so easy to simply walk away from these children of colonial parents and leave them to simply get on with their own mistakes.
Could I ask you a personal question? How has this played out in your own life, in your own upbringing, the religion of your family, or your own identification as a woman, as a Pakistani woman, as a Muslim?
I was, of course, brought up as a Muslim. My parents, particularly my mother, was a devout Muslim. I hugely admired her, and everything I have learnt as a woman, as a wife and a mother, I have learnt from my own mother. Mm. Although my own religious faith is nowhere like hers, what I appreciated in her case was the simplicity of her faith, which, I might add, she never wore on her sleeve. It was always a strictly private affair. When she prayed, we didn't know. It was always that quiet moment when, if I called for her and there was no answer, I knew she would be praying. It was something that she was clearly at ease with, and something that certainly was never imposed on any of her children. My father, of course, was an altogether more secular man, which is not to say that he didn't show up at congregations in the mosque for major Muslim festivals like Eid. He was there with all his peers. But none of it was oppressive. And
Was it political?
It was not at all political either, and there was absolutely no sense that our religious faith had any bearing on our conduct outside the home. I mean, I was educated in a Christian convent school. As far as my life now, well, I am certainly not a practicing Muslim. I am married to a man who was not Muslim by birth, but is not a practicing Christian either. My child did not receive a formal religious upbringing, but was certainly given, I hope, a very sound moral education, because I don't believe that a moral education necessarily has to be based on religion.
Back home in Pakistan, how many people would share your experience and your outlook, do you think?
I am not an exception. I am always asked this question, and I always answer in exactly the same way by saying that I am not an exception. There are many inside Pakistan who share my views, who have the same aspirations, who possibly even try to articulate them along these lines. The difficulty is, of course, that the channels for the free expression of opinion in Pakistan are extremely limited, and therefore people must choose their words very carefully if they are not to become the target of assaults and attacks by others. But there's no question in my mind that there are many in Pakistan who, while they may not agree with every single perspective of mine, share broadly the sentiments that I've expressed.
Farzana Sheikh, I'm wondering in general, what is the Pakistani perspective on this year of India, not just at Brown, but all over the place, a time of boom and Bollywood and high exposure at the Obama White House? How does Pakistan see what India is going through these days on the business pages, you know, on the movie pages, in the political headlines?
It's a very painful moment for Pakistan. Hmm. After all, the two countries emerged as independent entities at the same time in 1947. Pakistan, of course, was saddled with many more problems comparatively, but nevertheless, in the 1960s, appeared to show every sign of emerging as a progressive and reasonably economically sound state. Many of those expectations have since been dashed, and things seem to have gone from bad to worse. India, on the other hand, has, of course, galloped ahead. It's interesting that, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, when Pakistan's economic growth was bounding ahead. In Pakistan, you would hear many say, well, you know, India will forever be stuck with the so-called Indian rate of growth at hovering at around 3%. But of course,
the Hindu rate of growth,
exactly. And of course, as I said, you know, things have changed. It was also once argued that things between India and Pakistan politically were really not that different, and that, you know, India's democracy was purely what some describe as procedural, without any real substance. And those claims continue to be made. Nevertheless, the Indian political system has shown a degree of resilience and an astonishing capacity to settle and iron out many of those problems in a way that Pakistan, of course, has not, mainly because Pakistan quickly became subject to repeated interventions by the military in national politics, preempting any possibility of the country making headway, however small, in the direction of a more democratic dispensation. I mean, we weren't even allowed to make mistakes. I mean, unlike India, every time a correcting mechanism was needed, instead of being able to call on the constitution or on institutions, we called on the army, which is a completely different proposition in India, where because of a strong constitution and because of institutions that work better than those in Pakistan, which today, of course, has been left with broken institutions, India has all sorts of correcting mechanisms that work to a greater or lesser extent. So really, today, Pakistan can only sit and watch as its great rival, the rival with which, as I said at the beginning, it has always claimed parity and equality, forges ahead and is poised, it seems, to be accepted as a major player on the global stage. Pakistan, on the other hand, of course, is now being put on par not with India, but with a near-failing state, Afghanistan, in the form of this famous AFPAC formula that we've all been talking about, which many Pakistanis find deeply, deeply humiliating.
You've heard that joke that most countries have an army. In Pakistan, the army has a country. How much of this is America's doing over the years, and when?
Well, the United States must assume a very great part of the responsibility and blame for what has happened to Pakistan. And I think it's quite refreshing, certainly, to hear people at the highest levels in the U.S. administration, no less than Secretary of State Clinton, Defense Secretary Gates, all now accept and acknowledge that Pakistan and its misfortunes are the result also very largely of the conduct of former U.S. administrations, of U.S. policies in the past. And of all of these, none has angered Pakistan and ordinary Pakistanis more than the United States' patronage of Pakistan's military. For most Pakistanis, the fact that the United States, pretty much from the outset, has chosen always to negotiate with Pakistan's military establishment at the expense of its political parties, it is believed, and I think rightly, has given the army in Pakistan a clout which it would not otherwise have enjoyed.
When Mrs. Clinton was in Pakistan not so long ago, what I remembered was this young people, students, telling her that our conduct of the war on terror, including drones and covert interventions, was a huge burden and embarrassment.
Well, you know, I have gone on record many times, and I wouldn't be the only one, saying that those drone strikes have been wholly counterproductive. Others, close advisors to the U.S. administration, the U.S. military administration, have described and have gone as far as describing drone strikes as immoral. You simply don't bomb civilians in an allied country. It's unacceptable. But I think what is troubling about this is that many Pakistanis are also left in the dark as to whether or not these sorts of military strikes are being conducted, as they appear to be, with the connivance of Pakistan's own political and military leadership.
Farzana Sheikh, is the nightmare thought that an Islamic government could take over a nuclear arsenal in Pakistan, is that nightmare under control somewhere?
It's a paradox, but I think the confusion and the lack of consensus over Islam is both a curse and may also prove to be a blessing in Pakistan. The very fact that there is no consensus on what kind of Islam Pakistan is to represent may well suggest that any attempt to stamp one version is doomed to failure. I mean, we've come close to that in the 1980s, as I said, under the military regime of General Ziaul Haq. Of course, we have been left with the legacy of that regime in the form of immensely discriminatory laws, laws that discriminate both against women and against Pakistan's non-Muslim minorities. Nevertheless, the deep differences and the lack of any agreement on the role of Islam in the life of the state would seem to me to preempt any easy emergence of a so-called Islamic government.
Farzana Sheikh, it's a huge pleasure to read your book, Making Sense of Pakistan, and to talk through it. Thank you for joining us on Open Source.
Thank you.
Farzana Sheikh runs the Pakistan Study Group at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. Making Sense of Pakistan is her new book from Columbia University Press in New York. Ben Mandelkern edited our conversation with Farzana Sheikh. Paul McCarthy helped us get ready for it. Add your own experience, your questions, your wisdom on Pakistan in a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.